Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
Capital One has a fresh take on banking. Now you can open a new savings account in about 5 minutes and earn five times the national average. Banking with Capital One means five times the savings towards your dream honeymoon, or five times the savings towards your family's ultimate vacation. Even five times the savings towards just feeling good about saving. It's time to make your savings goals come true. This is Banking Reimagined. What's in your wallet? Capital One and a member FDIC.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Rosemary Main, and in the early hours of Saturday, November the 16th, these are our main stories. Donald Trump is accused of real-time witness intimidation as he live tweets through congressional impeachment hearings. Down but not out, a defiant message from Bolivia's ousted president. And echoes of the Cold War with a three-way spy swap on the Russian border. Also in this podcast, Venice draws breath after a week of flooding, and
minimally, the human right to internet access requires enough bandwidth for us to have equal opportunities to receive and send emails, blog, or to access social media, to access information online.
Is broadband internet access really that important? Shady interests the world over have learned how little it takes to remove an American ambassador. That's what the former US ambassador to Ukraine, who was fired by Donald Trump, has told the US president's impeachment inquiry in Washington. Maria Yovanovitch told the House Intelligence Committee that she'd felt threatened by Mr. Trump. Her priority, she said, as ambassador had been to fight corruption. But in the end, it was a Trump administration manipulated by corrupt foreign interests that had brought about her downfall.
Perhaps it was not surprising that when our anti-corruption efforts got in the way of a desire for profit or power, Ukrainians who preferred to play by the old corrupt rules sought to remove me. What continues to amaze me is that they found Americans willing to partner with them, and working together, they apparently succeeded in orchestrating the removal of a U.S. ambassador. How could our system fail like this?
And just when you thought it couldn't get any more dramatic, the U.S. president took to social media to attack Ms. Yovanovitch in the middle of her testimony. He tweeted, "Everywhere Marie Yovanovitch went turned bad." He also insisted it was a president's absolute right to appoint ambassadors. At the invitation of hearing Chairman Adam Schiff, Ms. Yovanovitch was given the opportunity to respond live during her televised testimony.
Ambassador, you've shown the courage to come forward today and testify, notwithstanding the fact you were urged by the White House or State Department not to, notwithstanding the fact that, as you testified earlier, the president implicitly threatened you in that call record, and now the president in real time is attacking you. What effect do you think that has on other witnesses' willingness to come forward and expose wrongdoing?
It's very intimidating.
Well, I want to let you know, Ambassador, that some of us here take witness intimidation very, very seriously.
Our North America editor, John Sopel, had this assessment of Marie Yovanovitch's testimony and the president's intervention.
This is a woman who has served for 33 years, her country, has been an ambassador in three different positions, very highly regarded, and is suddenly told, "You're fired, get on the next plane back home," because she'd fallen foul of Rudy Giuliani. So not only has she been fired, during the hearing, the president has obviously had his way in that she's been sacked, and he's now attacking her during the hearing while it is going on. And I tell you the thing I think is really powerful about it. The phrase was used, witness intimidation, by Adam Schiff, the Democratic chairman. That will become, potentially, another impeachable offence that will go on the charge sheet, if you like, when this comes to a vote, because they will say that this is witness intimidation, and it was striking afterwards that none of the Republicans would defend what the president had done. On Wednesday, when we had the two kind of senior officials, slightly grey men, very punctilious in the evidence that they gave. It was slightly underwhelming, and I think the Republicans felt they had a very good day because they had managed to say, look, all this evidence against the president is all second-hand or third-hand or fourth-hand. No one has actually spoken to the president directly. Well, here you have a very composed woman, Marie Yovanovitch, giving her evidence calmly, but with a hint of emotion and a hint of incredulity as well that this was unfolding to her. And I think the president putting out that tweet mid-evidence was very counterproductive. I don't think it will fray in the long term. I don't think you're going to suddenly see a wholesale rush of Republicans to back the Democrats' moves to impeach. But I think it has made them feel very uncomfortable.
While the impeachment drama unfolds in Congress, outside, the clock is ticking down to the next US presidential election in just under a year's time. How prosperous Americans feel come next November the 3rd could be a key factor in the result. According to official figures, the income gap between the rich and poor in the United States is now the widest for half a century. That's prompted two Democrat presidential hopefuls, Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders, to propose a new tax on the wealth of America's richest people. Very few countries currently impose such a tax. A wealth tax might trim the fortunes of rich Americans, but that doesn't mean they're all against it. In fact, more than 200 of them have formed a group called the Patriotic Millionaires. They believe the wealthy should bear a bigger share of the tax burden for the good of society at large. Mike Johnson has been speaking to one of them.
My name is Morris Pearl. I had the good fortune of having a successful career in computer engineering and finance. I ended up at the largest investment management company in the world, BlackRock.
So you've been a senior figure on Wall Street for some years. Are you what many people would consider to be super rich?
I'm not one of the richest people in the United States or even in my city of New York, but I've made enough money that I don't need to work anymore in my 50s. And, feel very comfortable retiring at an earlier age than most people.
You feel a wealth tax would be a good idea. Why is that?
Look, we used to have a system where the economy was growing every month, every year. People's income was going up at the top and at the bottom. Now, for the last couple of decades, we have a system where the economy is still growing. But the people at the bottom, like half of their country, their income is going down from year to year. The very fraction of the 1%, their income is going up a lot every year. For the first time, half of our country really believes that their children are going to grow up less well than they did, and they're right.
Why is that happening?
It's happening because our laws are being changed to favor the wealthy so much more than had been the case in the past. We have lower corporate taxes, lower taxes on business, lower taxes on investments, things that wealthy people pay, frankly. The tax rates have gone down in many ways for the wealthiest. So many Americans, like me, who invest their money and earn money from investments, do not pay anywhere near the kind of taxes regular working Americans pay on their wages and salaries.
Morris Pearl talking to Mike Johnson. The exiled former president of Bolivia, Evo Morales, has said he'll return to the country if the indigenous and social movements that support him call for him to do so. Speaking to the BBC in Mexico, he denied there were any meaningful charges that could be brought against him over the disputed election result, which ultimately forced his resignation. From La Paz in Bolivia, Will Grant reports.
Shortly after the interim president of Bolivia, Jeanine Añez, said that her predecessor, Evo Morales, could face charges if he returned to Bolivia, the exiled former president responded with characteristic defiance. "What charges can they bring against me? Electoral fraud?" he asked in an interview in Mexico City with the BBC's Spanish language service, BBC Mundo. "Do I administer the Electoral Commission?" he continued, arguing that several members of that body were key opposition figures. He also refuted the idea that he could be banned from any future vote.
"Internally, the social movements have great trust in me. So when they say another term of Evo, then why so much fear of Evo? Tell me. I have every right to participate in the elections. But instead it's no Evo, no Evo. If I want to return, it's Evo can't come back. Why so much fear of me?"
Meanwhile, in La Paz, the interim government continues to distance itself from Mr. Morales' socialist policies. The newly appointed Bolivian foreign minister, Karen Longarique, has announced the country is breaking ties with Venezuela, previously one of Bolivia's closest regional allies. She also said that more than 700 Cuban medics working in Bolivia are to be repatriated, bringing to an end a long-standing collaboration to provide health services in remote areas.
Will Grant. St. Mark's Piazza in Venice reopened to tourists on Friday, marking just the merest hint of a reprieve for residents of what is arguably the world's most beautiful city. The world-famous square had been forced to shut as Venice endured a succession of high tides. Schools, museums and businesses had been closed too, hitting the tourist revenues on which the city relies. The BBC's Jenny Hill has been out and about to see how the floods continue to surge and recede through Venice's canals.
Over the ancient bridges, through the winding waterways, the sound of flood sirens. Tourists, their shoes hurriedly wrapped in plastic bags, carry their suitcases along raised trestle walkways. Below them, water rises again in the streets of Venice. The city suffered its worst deluge in decades this week, and with subsequent high tides, the water comes seeping back into the city. Teresa Corbetti looked tired as, between tides, she tried to dry out the souvenir shop her family has run for a quarter of a century.
This is my family job. We work all inside the shop, and it's a disaster for our family and for all the Venetian people. Water is everywhere, and we cannot to sell more.
The beauty of this ancient city, fragile now. The damage expected to run to hundreds of millions of euros. Inside the rich, dark interior of St. Mark's Basilica, parts of which date back to the 11th century, a painful reckoning.
What has arrived up to the altar of the Madonna Nicopea, that is quite unusual. The last time was in 1966, and also the crypta was filled of water. Mm-hmm.
Monsignor Angelo Pagan, solemn in his black robes, tells us they're still trying to assess the damage.
Obviously, this is a problem in perspective, because when waters go down, everything immediately seems almost normal, except for dirty. But the salty water ruins the marbles and the floor. So the effect is a long-time effect. It's like radiation. Radiation immediately has no effect, but you see the effect after a few years.
I'm standing by the Grand Canal, and its murky green water is level with the street. The water's slapping over onto the paving stones, and it's starting to seep into shops and businesses. The water levels here have been up and down over the last few days, and you really get a sense of just how vulnerable Venetians are to the water and how really unprotected this city is against this kind of flooding.
Venice lies low in the water, prone to flooding and vulnerable to the effects of climate change. But a huge flood defence project has been delayed for years by corruption, scandal and overspend. What happened here this week is raising fundamental questions about how best, long-term, to protect this city from the water that surrounds it. Water that continues to rise, fall and rise again.
Jenny Hill in Venice. Still to come, the grannies going back to school in South Korea. Now to news of a rather remarkable spy swap. Two Russians jailed for espionage have been pardoned and freed in Lithuania in exchange for two Lithuanians and a Norwegian held in Russia. Our correspondent in Moscow, Steve Rosenberg, gave me the details.
The key to the release was the Lithuanian president today pardoned two Russian nationals who'd been convicted of espionage. That was the key for Russia to release two Lithuanians. It had jailed for spying, plus a Norwegian citizen, Frode Berg. And the actual swap, we believe, took place on the Russian-Lithuanian border.
Now, Frode Berg, as you mentioned, admitted acting as a courier for Norwegian intelligence, but denied spying. What do we know about the rest of them?
Well, as for the Russians who were released, both men had been convicted of espionage in Lithuania, of trying to recruit Lithuanian citizens. Nikolai Filipchenko, he'd been sentenced to 10 years in prison. Lithuania said he was an agent of the FSB, Russia's security service. The other man, we believe, was Sergei Maisienko. They were arrested a couple of years ago. The Lithuanians, released by Russia, they were jailed in 2016.
This has taken at least a few weeks to plan, hasn't it? Quite complicated. And how did the exchange actually happen in the end?
Spy swaps are always difficult to negotiate. This one, especially, involving three countries, Russia, Lithuania and Norway. The swap actually took place, we believe, on the border of Lithuania and Russia. As for Frode Berg, it's an interesting case because he denied being a spy, and yet he had admitted to working as a courier for Norwegian intelligence. He'd been delivering envelopes to various sources in Russia, although he said he didn't know what was in the envelopes. And his wife has publicly blamed Norway's intelligence service for putting her husband at risk. She said she had absolutely no idea what he'd been up to.
Official figures have confirmed the cost that months of unrest is having on Hong Kong's economy. New figures show that the former British colony has entered its first recession in a decade, with no end in sight to months of increasingly violent protests. The unrest continued on Friday with more disruption on major roads and the city's underground rail system, and students continuing to barricade university campuses. The BBC's Gabriel Gatehouse has been reporting regularly from Hong Kong since the protests began in June. He's back in the territory this week and has been inside one of the campuses to see for himself what's happening.
I'm on the campus of Hong Kong Polytechnic University, and the students here basically clad in black. I can see them milling all around here, a lot of them wearing masks, some of them with improvised weapons. They've basically barricaded themselves into this university campus. They've made improvised weapons, catapults, they've got bows and arrows from the archery department, they've got Molotov cocktails, petrol bombs, essentially just glass bottles filled with a flammable liquid and a rag on top that you can light, and they are all waiting for the arrival of the police. They believe they're going to come in here and try and clear them out. Now, I spent most of last night here. I spent nearly all of today here. And so far, the police have not shown up in any great numbers. But as is always the case in these situations, rumours spread like wildfire, especially on messaging apps. So twice in the last hour or so, I've seen people suddenly rush to one end of the campus with rumours that the police are arriving. They've so far turned out not to be true.
Gabriel Gatehouse. Here in the UK, campaigning ahead of next month's general election is intensifying. The opposition Labour Party has promised to give every home and business free, fast internet access by the year 2030 if it wins. The ruling Conservatives say they will bring fast internet to every UK home 5 years earlier. There's a global debate about whether the internet has become so important to our lives it should be a basic human right, like access to water. In 2016, the UN declared that it should, because the internet allowed people to exercise their right to freedom of opinion and expression. Finland became the first country in the world to make fast internet access or broadband a legal right for every citizen back in 2010. This month, the Indian state of Kerala declared broadband access should be a human right for its 35 million people. Thomas Isaac is Kerala's finance minister.
Kerala is one of the states in India where basic education, basic healthcare, food, housing is almost guaranteed right of every household. In this new information age, the poor are left out. We don't want that to happen in Kerala. Therefore, we have decided to make it a basic right of every citizen in Kerala to have access to internet. This will be a big game changer. Almost every house has somebody's child studying the school or college, and these children are going to help their parents to access government services through internet. It will transform our governance system.
Dr. Merton Reglitz is a lecturer in global ethics at the University of Birmingham in the English Midlands.
I would think that the internet is a human right because we need it these days
for leading minimally decent lives, we cannot exercise our political rights, which are part of a minimally decent life, if we do not have access to the internet. You would not die necessarily if you don't have the right to vote or if you don't have the right to free speech. But these rights are important elements of a minimally decent life, and that's also why they're very central in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. I would think that minimally, the human right to internet access requires enough bandwidth, so to speak, for us to have equal opportunities to receive and send emails, blog, or to access social media, to access information online. On the other hand, though, states should also try to progressively promote better infrastructure to narrow digital gaps that might exist right now. So in that sense, the idea of a human right to internet access is very similar to the idea to the human right to health.
Dr. Mertin Reglitz. Increased affluence means more rubbish, and China, for one, is learning that the hard way. Its largest dump, the Jiangsu and Go landfill site in Shanxi province, is already full 25 years ahead of schedule. It's about the size of 100 football pitches and was designed to take 2,500 tonnes of rubbish a day. Instead, it's getting four times that, more than any other dump in China. Professor Peter Hayes-Greece is director of the Manchester China Institute. What does he think lies behind the country's burgeoning refuse crisis?
I think you could argue that it all centers around President Xi Jinping's promise to the Chinese people of a China dream. And the domestic component of that promise is essentially a middle-class lifestyle, which has been promised by 2021, just a little over a year from now. And, you know, the conveniences of modern life, owning a car, refrigerators, all of these butt up against quality of life issues that are implicated by pollution, health, NIMBY kinds of not in my backyard protest movements. There's also international dimensions to it, the desire that he make China great again, the promise that he make China great again. And I think that that has contributed to a national pride, which has contributed to the problem of no more international recyclables, plastics being exported to China.
As a symbol of just the huge amount of stuff that is thrown away by people in one city in China, I mean, it's quite striking, isn't it?
Yeah, it's massive. I mean, the scale is mind-boggling. It's hard to conceptualize such a large landfill. Now, one thing in Xi'an was that they did not invest in incinerators. So that may be one explanation for why this happened so quickly. But it also has to do, again, with the dramatic increase in the middle class and their demand for all the conveniences of modern life.
And you mentioned not taking rubbish from abroad. I mean, is that part of that pride you were talking about?
Yes. President Xi Jinping has promoted the idea of a China dream. And central to that is this idea that China becomes great again. And a big part of that is China's international image. And no Chinese wants the world to look at China as the world's trash collector.
Professor Peter Hayes-Greece talking to James Menendez. South Korea has one of the lowest birth rates in the world. The impact is being keenly felt in rural areas where schools are struggling to fill classrooms and stay open. Facing a year without any first graders, a school in the southwest of the country decided to open its doors to illiterate grandmothers who'd asked to learn to read and write. Laura Bicker has been to meet them.
We will study hard, these grandmothers tell their teacher. For decades, they've dreamed of learning to read and write. Now that they have their chance, every moment in this first grade class is special.
When I was young, I couldn't go to school because I had to raise my siblings. Now that I'm older, I heard this was a good opportunity. That's why I'm doing it.
I never went to school because we were poor. Now I'm learning new things and realizing it is really nice to go to school.
They've lived most of their lives sacrificing for their families, usually male siblings.
Lee Ju-young is the school's principal.
There was a culture of sending sons to school but not daughters. The root cause was poverty.
This rural school in the southwest coast of South Korea once had 90 pupils in each grade. Now there are only 22 students in total.
Hello. Hello.
Shona. Babies are becoming an increasingly rare sight in rural areas, as South Korea's birth rate plummets to one of the lowest in the world. As a result, South Korea is running out of children and has a growing elderly population. But amidst this crisis has come a rare opportunity. Wang Bok Nim spent most of her time alone at a small farm before starting first grade. Her mother kept telling her she would go to school one day. It turns out that day was in her 75th year.
All the other kids went to school, but I couldn't. Back then, kids would wrap their school supplies, sling it on their shoulders. When they ran, the pencil case would rattle and make noises. I was so jealous of that. I even tried to imitate it by myself at home.
She shows off huge paper calendars rolled up at the back of her small house.
Everyone gives me extra calendars. I use the back of them to practice writing. What would I do now that I'm old? Really though, if I was just 60 years old, I would have gone all the way to college. I think those who went to college, they must know everything.
No one appears to have any answers for South Korea's demographic crisis. But this village is offering Hwang's generation a chance to make up for lost time and a lost education.
That report from our correspondent in Seoul, Laura Bicker. And that's all from us for now, but there will be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Rosemary Main. Until next time, goodbye.
Hang on a minute, don't go just yet. I have a thing to ask you. We are coming up to Happy News Pod time and we'd like to hear from you. If a very lovely thing has happened to you this year or you've achieved something wonderful, just record a sentence telling us who and where you are and what was the thing that made your heart sing. Then send it as an email attachment to globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. Thank you. That's it. You can go now.